you look at the competition at lock, and then you think of the fact that Ryan Baird had a concussion, then you think of guys like Tom O'Hearn coming through the system, he probably needed to come on and be really explosive and dynamic.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Daily.
All right, it is the build-up to Christmas, which means it is goal mile season, and goal ambassador Eamon Coughlin, I'm delighted to say, is here with us in studio. Eamon, good to see you. How are you keeping?
I'm keeping very, very well, Owen. Thanks very much for having me in, and it's a great pleasure to be able to talk about the goal mile again. I think the goal mile and Christmas are synonymous after all these years now, 40-odd years of running in the goal mile, which brings a lot of our community, you know, your friends, your neighbours, your teammates, whatever it might be, all coming together on one day or now over a week, depending on what day the club wants to put it on, just to help those very, very unfortunate people around the world that Goal try to look after.
You've been involved with this from ground level, basically.
Well, pretty much going back to the very early 80s, Goal was founded 47 years ago by John O'Shea. And at the time, we had a lot of really good runners in Ireland, and we still do to this very day, obviously. However, having said that, Noel Carroll, the great 800-metre runner, was very much involved with Goal. And he came up with the idea, because we had such good runners in Ireland, why don't we put on the Goal Mile? So the Goal Mile started in Belfield way back, I think it was 1980 or 81 when it first commenced, and it's been on every year ever since. And that was always the focal point out in UCD. However, it has grown now, and every small town and village and all around the country have goal miles on around Christmas time.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to find out more, goalmile.org is where you can go to learn about the history of it, to find your local mile as well. I know we're probably going to be engaging in it in some capacity with Off the Ball. I think we'll probably give it a go. Most of us will give it a lash over the course of the next few weeks as well. So that's all coming up. I know you've been doing a lot of work with Goal quite recently as well. You've been in Africa with Goal as well.
Yeah, Goal USA was set up earlier this year, and Eamon Sharkey from Goal asked me if I'd go to New York to try and launch the Great Ethiopian Run Challenge and get some of the volunteers in America to come to Ethiopia to witness at first hand exactly what the conditions are like out there. So we launched the event in New York. We got a great response from the volunteer board over in New York, and I think there was about 15 or 16 of us went out to Ethiopia to run in Haile Gebrselassie's Great Ethiopian Run with 50,000 participants in it. It was mind-blowing. So I went out there with Goal, and we went up to some of the various areas in Ethiopia where Goal are on the ground helping these unfortunate people.
What did you learn when you got to the country and when you saw what's happening on the ground there? Obviously, it was a great experience for you to be involved in the run, but obviously the context of where you are as a country, I'm sure, affects you in some significant way.
Yeah, really, it was, you know, you haven't been involved in all those years. It didn't really strike a chord on until I was out there and I saw on the ground, you know, the poverty, the malnutrition, the lack of hygiene, the lack of clean water, the lack of food, where these kids have absolutely nowhere to go. And we went into one area in Addis Ababa called Child Space, where the kids are taken off the street, where they're shown the various basic skills in life, where they're taught how to clean themselves, how to feed themselves, where they're taught how to look after themselves, because after 5 o'clock in the evening, those kids are back out on the streets again. And it is just frightening to see the existence of life down there in those unfortunate areas. So that's what really struck me the most, how important it is to get the message out about what Goal is doing around the world, not just in Ethiopia, but many other countries around the world. There are 60 countries around the world where people have been devastated by war, by crisis. It's just really, really heartbreaking to see what's going on there.
It must be a battle for Goal day in, day out, in terms of resources, in terms of trying to feel like you're making a difference, because I presume in that sort of situation you can often feel like a drop in the ocean in terms of what you're actually contributing.
Well, unfortunately the numbers are increasing all the time. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, if Goal and the other NGOs weren't on the ground in these places, those people would be just left to fend for themselves and they'd be left to die. And examples of that was when I was in space camp and all these lovely little children were there, and as we went around the various rooms being given a rundown on how the operation was working in this particular school, I said to some of my colleagues there, listen to the noise out the window. And they go, what? I said, listen to the noise. And they said, what about it? I said, it's children playing the same sound you'd hear in the schools in Dublin or the playgrounds in Dublin or New York or Los Angeles. I said, those children are very happy out there. They don't know the difference. But when you think then that when school ends and they're back out on the streets again, fending for themselves, it really, really, it's very, 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 very sad. But those kids would be left to die. If those children don't have, for example, identification, if they've been abandoned by their parents, whether it's 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years of age, if they hadn't been registered, their birth that is, and all of a sudden they become ill or injured or whatever it might be, the hospitals don't even want to know about them. So Goal, at least, are on the ground with their people out in Ethiopia who really have put together fantastic programs to try and make a little bit of difference to these unfortunate kids. And like, as I said, there's 75,000 children alone on the streets of Addis Ababa who are just wandering around hungry, and it's very, 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 very sad to see what's going on. And then at Christmas time, when we think of what we have over here, when children want to get a new iPhone or a new pair of football boots or a new iPad or whatever it might be, you know, you just forget, hey, there's a lot more people in the world suffering, and these other things in life are inconsequential.
Is it your... How many trips have you made with Gold to areas where they're doing their great work?
This is my first,
oh, it was your first
trip
one?
Over the years.
Really,
yeah,
right.
Like I've been involved, as I say, with various charities, but particularly with Gold. It's always around Christmas time because of the Gold Mile. And when they asked me to go to Ethiopia, I said, like, why not? Let's go and have a look and see exactly what they're doing. So when people are asked to make their donations, and you see all the charities at this time of the year asking for people to make donations to help these people who've been devastated by crisis, just to see exactly how professional, how well structured that the Goal organization is to help these people.
I hadn't realized it was your first time going to Ethiopia or to Africa, mm-hmm. and it must have been just a complete eye-opener then in that context for you.
It was an eye-opener, you know, just to see the shanty little towns that the people live in. They don't have anything. They're walking tens and scores of miles, if you like, with straw on their back, with sticks on their back, with rice on their back, with potatoes on their back, just to go to the local market to try and pick up a few small dollars, if you like, to help feed their families. And it's just insane, you know, the poverty that we're looking at and the type of living conditions, no running water, no electricity, that the people have to endure.
It must have also been incredible to be involved in the run. I mean, that sounds like an incredible event.
Yeah, I came out of retirement to do my first 10K in a long, long time. The last time I ran was the Gold Mile last year. But yeah, Haile Gebrselassie, who's the former great Olympic champion, world record holder, known as the Emperor in Ethiopia. Back in 2001, after he won the world championships, he set up the Great Ethiopian Run. And over the years, it has grown into 50,000 participants in the event, and it's only over 10K, it's over a full marathon distance where they'd have time to kind of spread out and make your way through the crowds. But when it's only 10K, you know, you are in danger of being stampeded. If you stop for any second, you're going to get run over. But the colour and the pageantry and the music and the entertainment around there was just fantastic. And I think the people of Ethiopia, and particularly Addis Ababa, they love the event because it's giving the locals an opportunity to get out, both men and women. And, you know, just to be able to run around with those and shuffle along through these shanty little towns and see what the people are living through just, you know, blew my mind.
Is it the sport that beats all other sport in Ethiopia? I presume football is pretty high in the hierarchy there as well. But in terms of the international sporting legends that they've produced, I presume running has a very special place in their hearts.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you go back to Midas Yifter in 1980 Olympic Games, Muhammad Wold, many great champions from Ethiopia going back to when I was a child.
Abibi Bekele?
Abibi Bekele being the first of them. That's right. I grew up, you know, reading about these people, and then subsequent to that, all the great women athletes out of Ethiopia and the men athletes out of Ethiopia. It's the number one sport. And we went up to northern part of Ethiopia, Tigray, and we were in the sticks in the middle of nowhere, and we came to this beautiful big temple, and there was this gentleman here dressed up in his native garb, and I asked him, did he know Haile Gebrselassie? And he goes, ah, Haile, of course. And I took out a photograph with Haile and I that I had just been with him the day before. Sure, I was God all of a sudden. And because I was a former world champion myself, that was even more important. But it was really fantastic. fantastic experience going to these places. And even Haile Gebrselassie, when I agreed to go to Ethiopia, I made contact with Haile. I told him that I was bringing the gold team from USA over to Ethiopia to run in the 10K race. Would it be okay if we got a private reception with you? So he was very, very appreciative of the fact that Eamon Coughlin was coming over to Ethiopia with his team. And in the Haile Hotel in Addis Ababa, he hosted us to a beautiful dinner and a reception where all the guys on the team met the great Emperor Haile Gebrselassie. And that really made a difference to our people who were raising a lot of money in America for gold, to be able to go over there and just connect with Haile Gebrselassie, connect with the organisation on the ground, to be able to really deliver what was needed most.
Did you get any insights into the sporting organisation there in terms of the success that they achieved? Because obviously they've got incredible athletes that do go on to achieve great things. Quite often, unfortunately, it's just due to the fact that they are the best, and it's not necessarily to do with any organisational structure or anything like that. Yeah. But I wonder if there is something that they're doing.
Yeah, good question. And I asked the same question when I was over there. Do they have athletics clubs like we do in Ireland or in the UK or in the United States? They have a sports academy, and they have, if you like, coaches on the ground who are out there identifying some of the better teenage runners, and they're taking them to the sports academy in Addis Ababa where they train. And they're training at, 8,500 feet in altitude. So if they're identifying a really good athlete at teenage level, they're brought into that program and they're gradually brought along to the senior ranks. So it seems to be well structured in that regard.
Where did you finish in the race?
I didn't count the position, but my objective was to try and break 70 minutes, and I just about ran 69 minutes and 59 seconds. I shuffled along.
It's amazing. We were chatting to Catriona McKiernan in studio here last week, and she was just kind of reflecting on the last few years for the sport of running in this country, where she kind of looks back on 2019 and 2020, COVID comes along and there's been this boom in running here in Ireland. And I do wonder if we look back on 2024 as a year where there was another little nudge along with things. And I'm talking obviously about the success of some of our athletes from the European Championships to the Paris Games. I think 24 will go down as a big old year for Irish athletics.
Yeah, there's no question about it. 2024 was a phenomenal year, and I think it was phenomenal from the point of view, besides the performance, it was the first time in many, many, many years that people were talking about athletics. It was front of the newspapers. It was almost first thing on the sports news throughout the Olympic Games in Paris, when our swimmers and our gymnasts and our athletes were all performing at world-class level, winning Olympic gold medals, and Kelly coming back and winning the boxing again. So 2024 was definitely a big year for Irish athletics compared to the 80s, when I was fortunate enough to be at world level, and John Tracy and Frank O'Mara and Ray Flynn, all of a sudden people are now talking about it. But the best thing about it is it's right across the board, you know, from our ladies in the 400 metres led by Rashida and the relay teams, and then them winning the medal in the World Relay Championships with Thomas Barr and Chris O'Donnell on the team as well. And then you also had in the 1500 metres this year, while they mightn't have really made the headlines, we've got five or six 1500 metre runners, starting with Andrew Coskeran, who can run 3:30 for 1500 metres. Luke McCann can run 3:33. And also then Cathal Doyle, 3:33, 1500 metres, who won the repetage in the Olympic Games. And these athletes are not even heard of. So there's a great, great, great range across men and women's disciplines in athletics at the moment that have never been there before.
How does that success then translate into real terms, in terms of people getting involved in the sport and getting involved in their local athletics clubs, in terms of government investing in facilities that might be available to young aspiring athletes? Because we've had that success piece now, it feels, this year, and the Olympic year is always a bit of an opportunity. What's the next step, do you feel, for 2024 to have been capitalised upon?
Well, I think the next step has already been put in front of us, from the point of view that the registration and athletic clubs around the country has gone through the roof this year.
Right.
You know, our athletic club, MSB Athletic Clubs, up in the Castleknock, Blanchardstown area, sure, we have waiting lists now. And if you look at all the other clubs around the country, there's waiting lists for them to get in. So, you know, there's an old saying, if you want to make a monkey famous, you know, put the monkey on television, you make a monkey famous. If you want to make a sports famous, put the sport on television and you make it famous. So we got to see how these athletes performed this year. And as a result, while the mam and dads were looking at it and excited that we were going to win some medals, the kids were tuned into it as well. And all of a sudden, they wanted to become a Charlene Morsey or a Sophie Becker or a Rashida Adeleke. They all want to now perform. And thus, the increase in people trying to sign up for the athletic clubs. And with athletics getting more and more prominence now, television is covering a lot more, kids are more tuned in, the names are becoming household names, they'll want to emulate those athletes that are participating at a high level in the world today. So I think over the next 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to have really really good athletes coming because they can. They believe they can do it. They believe they will live on the world stage. And not only that, the support that the government has been putting into our sports, both men's sports and women's sports over the years, developing structures, corporate governance structures, the fruits of all of that are coming to the fore right now by what happened this year in Paris, for sure. And I think it's only going to get better.
Sport is obviously a pretty brutal thing, especially for the individual sports such as athletics. It's a couple of different stories I'd love to chat to you about from the year. The first one is just Ciara Mageean.
Yeah.
The high of winning European gold and then not getting to compete in the Olympic Games. How do you think she'll reflect on her year at this point? I presume it takes years for somebody's, one of their most significant years of their career, to actually fully digest. But I presume there's still a bit of a rawness about not being able to compete in the Olympic Games while also the high of that gold in June.
Yeah, it was a tragedy for her not to be able to get to the Olympic Games with the injury she had. And to be quite honest with you, it was a mirror image of what I went through back in 1980 for the Olympic Games. 2 weeks before the Games, I had to pull out because of a stress fracture. This was the 1984 Olympic Games, having won the World Championships the year before, and now you come back 1984, you're getting ready, you're the favourite, you're in the magazines, you're the favourite to win, and all of a sudden you're torn down by an injury. It's a tough blow, it really is, and it takes a while to get over it. And she's just going to have to let, you know, time be the cure of all of this. But it's going to be tough for her because she's now 32 years of age. She'll be 36 when it comes to the Los Angeles Olympic Games. So I think she'll come to realisation that she did give it her all. She'll come to realisation whether she'll want to continue for 4 more years at that high level, whether the younger kids are going to come through and beat her. That's some decision that she's going to have to make for herself. But the fact that she was on the top rung on the podium, I should say, winning the European gold medal in the 1500 metres was a vindication of the career that we all expected her to have from the time she was a teenager, winning national championships, finishing second in the World Junior Championships over 1500 metres. Ciara always wanted to be a winner. She didn't like losing. She always wanted to win. So I think it'll be very, very hard for her to accept that she was injured, but time will cure that, and the realisation that she was at least a world medalist at junior level and a senior European championship. I think she'd be very happy with that at the end, if that's the way it's going to be.
How long did it take you to get over what happened in 84?
It didn't take me too long to get over what happened in 84, because having finished fourth twice in 1976 and 1980, I haven't got over that yet.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah, no, it's disappointing, all right, you know, when you finish so close but yet so far. But at the same time, it makes you a stronger person, that's for sure. It makes you a stronger athlete. And I was devastated when I missed a gold medal by literally a couple of tenths of a second in fourth place, and a second out of a gold medal in 1980 in fourth place again. And while it devastated me there, it made me really hungry to come back again. And the coming back for me was running the first ever sub-350 indoor mile back in 1983, and then to win the World Championships in Helsinki in 1983. That made up for every disappointment that I would have had. So I was lucky to be able to go out on a high like that.
That's interesting, because not every sports person says that the wins make up for the disappointments. They want none of the disappointments, all of the wins, because they wouldn't be these different mental beasts otherwise if they didn't want to win every single race. That almost the memories of the losses, the defeats, the moments where you underperform coexist with the high moments, but they actually supersede the high moments in terms of how deeply you feel them.
Yes and no. I was very fortunate too from the point of view, while I was really disappointed to end my career not winning an Olympic gold medal. I didn't want a silver, I didn't want a bronze, and that's not being cocky. I just felt good enough to be able to win these races, and if you just say 0.3 of a second or a second from first to fourth, well, that's not that far away from it all. But I was happy that while I ended my elite career disappointed, I went out eventually on my own terms. And going out on my own terms at 40 years of age was to try and become the first person over 40 to run under 4 minutes for the mile. So 40 years after Sir Roger Bannister ran the first ever sub 4 minute mile, I did go out running 3:57, 3:58 for the mile. And that was the self-satisfaction alone in that made up for everything, because I didn't go out disappointed. I went out on my terms.
I presume in hindsight you would have taken bronze though in 76 or 80.
You know what? Only in hindsight you could probably say yes.
Yeah,
yeah, you would have though. You would, like Sonia.
Yeah.
Sonia O'Sullivan wants a gold medal.
Of course.
Sonia, when she finished second behind Szabo in Australia and Sydney, was disappointed.
Of course.
But then as time goes by, whew, she has that bit of Siva wear forever and ever and ever. And I don't think that disappointment lasted too long with Sonia at all.
No, there's something very tangible to show for it. Speaking of finishing fourth, it's obviously been the experience of Rashida this year, and the fourth place finish in her final was something that she discussed with David Gillick immediately afterwards as something that was a real disappointment to her. There was no sort of, you ran a great race, you're so young, you've got multiple more games in front of you. The feeling was acute. This was the be-all and end-all for her in that moment, which it kind of has to be, right, when you're approaching any Olympic Games with a sense of competitiveness.
Yeah. Well, again, I was the same age as Rashida going back to in 1976 when I finished fourth.
Right.
So I know exactly what it was like. I was devastated. I cried my eyes out afterwards when I finished fourth place because I didn't want to finish fourth. I wanted to finish first. And it's exactly the same with Rashida. The expectations on Rashida this year are huge. A year ago, people didn't even know her name. A year ago, people didn't, outside of athletics, didn't know her. Well, we all knew her from the time she was a young teenager coming through. So the expectations from the general public were huge on her. But not only that, she put those expectations on herself. Why? Because she's a class act. She's a great runner. She's a great racer. She's a great racing brain. She knows how to run the 100, the 200, the 400. But you have to remember, too, that she just graduated from college just before last May, just before the Olympic Games. So in other words, she was a rookie. A rookie when it came to the international scene, and particularly a rookie when it came to the Olympic Games. Now, there's a big difference between going to the National Collegiate Championships in America, going through your heat and getting into the final and winning it, than there is in the Olympic Games. You've got three races, your heats, your semi-finals and your finals. And she was competing against, you know, three girls who were, what, 6 and 7 years older than her?
Yeah.
So they've got 6 and 7 years more of physical maturity, mental maturity, and they've been through all these rounds in major competitions before her. So while she was expecting herself to win gold, and maybe hopefully a medal, but she wanted gold, just, I think, it just drained the energy out of her going through the first round, going through the second round, and then the emotional energy on top of that also took its toll on her. However, to finish fourth for her was a spectacular performance because, as I say, she's only 22, so we can expect an awful lot more out of her over the next 4 years, if not 8 years. And over the next 4 years, she'll be 4 years stronger and she'll be 4 years healthier, hopefully, and she'll scare the daylights out of anybody that lines up on her in a track.
Definitely. It's just at this moment when we all look back on the year that was, and it goes back to this having the tangible thing of the medal. The Olympic Games were just such a success for Ireland, and as you've mentioned, there was the likes of Kelly and Daniel Whiffen and Paul and Fintan in the boat winning gold medals, and then obviously even you think of the bronze medal in rowing as well with Philip and Dara. And it, again, it's just such a basic sort of human instinct that if you have the tangible thing, you're automatically on a pedestal, and it is just such a shame that, sure, there was Rome, where there was a couple of gold medals, never mind medals, and that was fantastic for the athletics year in general. But if there was that bronze medal that we could have taken away from the athletics, the Olympic Games would have been on a pedestal above, because people realised the value of an athletics medal compared to other sports as well. I just couldn't help thinking this week when I was kind of thinking we were going to have this conversation that there was still just that elephant in the room about what happened in that race with Rashida in that final, and that she was beaten by Salwa Eid Nasser of Bahrain, who finished second despite for whereabouts failings in the past, yeah. despite serving a multiple-year, two-year ban for whereabouts failings. And it just feels like a real bitter note at the end of the Olympic Games, where almost Rashida's moment was robbed by somebody who has serious questions to answer. And when she was asked those questions at the Olympic Games, showed no real sense of contrition or no real idea that she had actually done wrong in the past.
Yeah, you can't really, when you're lining up against the other athletes, you're not going to be saying, I wonder if she or he or whatever it might be on it, whatever way you finish. And if you do finish fourth, you don't really look and say, well, I think that, God, it was in second place, was cheating, you know. You don't hold on to that. It doesn't become a grudge. You accept what the result is and you move on. And the fact that, as I say, that she is so young, and the fact that she finished fourth is going to make her really very, very, very hungry to come out and vindicate herself, if she does need to be vindicated, by winning in the Olympics. I have no doubt. I said last year, I think she can win an Olympic gold medal. I was hoping she'd do it in Paris, but I really believe that with 4 more years of maturity and training under our belt, and the experience of competing at European level, at Olympic level and world level, she is going to be in there and become the superstar we're all expecting her to be.
For sure. And we did speak to her about this. We spoke to her coach about this as well. And Coach Flo kind of took the line, don't kick the dog in the street, I think was his line. So that they're very much tunnel vision. And I can understand that, that approach to it. I guess it's for us as fans to get annoyed about this, but it's also, I mean, I'm very keen to just get your opinion on it. Like, your honest opinion, how did you feel when that information was out there that somebody who had failed multiple whereabouts findings pretty egregiously and was banned had beaten an Irish up-and-coming superstar? Like, even allowing for all of our biases, how did you feel about that?
I didn't think about it, to be quite honest with you.
Really?
Because there's nothing you can do. It's outside of your control.
As a spectator.
If World Athletics were allowing her in there because she fulfilled whatever little bit of a punishment she might have done, and they let her in, well, it's out of your control and there's nothing you can do about it. And if you go back to 1980 Olympic Games, when I finished fourth, the guy that was in third place, Karlo Mininka,
the Finnish fellow,
From Finland, he won a silver in the 10 and a bronze in the 5, and a short time after the Olympic Games, he became a born-again Christian and he decided, you know, hey, I shouldn't have accepted these medals. So what did he do? He threw them into a lake up somewhere in Finland, looking for forgiveness for cheating in the Olympic Games. What did the Olympic movement do? They didn't honour me, the Olympic bronze medal, and I wouldn't have even taken it because I wasn't looking for somebody to hand me down a medal at all. I finished fourth, they accepted I finished fourth, and I moved on. When it's out of your control, you can't look back and just wonder. And as a fan, you can always talk about it. It gives conversation. She shouldn't have been allowed in. Well, why was she allowed in? She was allowed in because World Athletics allowed her in.
Is that good enough, that World Athletics allowed her in?
Possibly no, but unless, you know, 3 strikes and you're out, maybe that's the rule that should come in and you never be allowed to compete again. But there's too much ambiguity there.
You mentioned the athlete from Finland who came third in your race, right? Because he won, as you mentioned, silver in the 10,000 in 1980. Like, he was blood doping, and now it wasn't outlawed at the time, which is astonishing to think about it. But now, what we know through cycling in particular, what the benefits possibly are. I mean, like, it's you have absolutely no sort of issue with that at all. You've kind of forgiven that moment in general, like, because that was your Olympic medal that was taken by a blood doper, essentially.
Yeah, I never thought of it, to be quite honest with you, at all.
Really?
No, never, ever, ever, ever. I never look back and say, oh, I wish he would have said to me, here, I give it to you, Eamon, rather than throwing it in the lake.
Sure.
No. And I know over the years, one of my dear friends, George Kimball, great writer who passed away a number of years ago, when Chapinski from East Germany won the marathon back in 1976 Olympic Games, many, many years later, he came out and says he was systematically doped. That was the system over there. So, and I shouldn't have won the Olympic gold medal in the marathon. Frank Shorter then went after him. He finished second, even though he won in 72. He was looking for his second Olympic gold medal. So George was in pursuit of this story, and he asked me, Eamon, is it okay if I pursued the story for you? And I go, what? He said, that guy, Mininka, he threw his medal away because he said he was cheating. Okay, blood doping might have been bad, planned. But at the same time, he admitted himself, he's cheating. What do you think? And I said, absolutely no. I don't want to be included in that conversation. But I think we should go to the Olympic Council of Ireland, to Mr. Hickey, and ask Mr. Hickey. Well, Mr. Hickey said, no, we're not going to pursue that. Blood doping wasn't illegal at the time, even though it was a form of cheating. But, you know, I just moved on and never even looked back with any type of sympathy, if you like, for myself, that I should have been handed a medal.
What about for the next Eamon Coughlin? Did you ever think, Jesus, if there is a coterie of nations, which was a thing in the 1980s, let's not forget, where there was this perception and reality where there were certain nations who were involved in state-sponsored doping, there was a lot of advantages that they might have had, or you could have at least had the perception that they were. Do you not think to yourself, geez, I really hope that the next Eamon Coughlin doesn't come along and get screwed over like I did?
No, I don't look back and say I got screwed over. To be quite honest with you, I never looked back like that. In terms of looking to the future, all you can do is encourage the great milers, particularly in the 1500 metres, if you talk about Eamon Coughlin, and we have four or five great guys there who actually, incidentally, without changing the subject, why don't we get them to come out and try and break the 4x1 mile relay record? We have the four that can do it now. But no, any young lad that's coming through right now, Andrew Cosgrove, and, you know, Nick Griggs, the young, he's only 19, he'll be 20, I think, this week, who won a silver medal in the under 23 championships at the weekend. Cathal Doyle, who I said, and Luke McCann. We've got four great, and Keane McPhillips is another lad whom we haven't even mentioned. We've got some great middle distance runners out there right now who've got ambitions again for the next Olympic Games. So all you do is encourage them to train fairly, to train squarely, to do the very, 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 very best they can, and hopefully, you know, be successful in terms of winning a medal. But not to be prepared in advance saying, oh, I wonder, are they going to do this? Or maybe I should start taking EPO. You can't go down that route at all. You've just got to focus on yourself and do what's right.
For sure. Just one last thing on that. I think it was Ger who was chatting to you here in 2016, right before the Rio Olympics. And I think you made the point that you'd lost your emotional ties a little bit with the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Is that still the case 8 years on, or have you rediscovered a connection?
Absolutely. Rediscovered the connection in the last few years, big time.
What's changed?
Because when you put an athlete out there representing Ireland and they're winning, when people start talking about it, when you start getting excited about seeing our own Irish athletes on television again, right up there challenging for success on the Diamond League or whatever it might be, and you see a number of great young athletes coming through, and Sarah Lavin in the and this young and Doody in the long jump, Elizabeth Lynn Doody. We've got such great talent out there. This, in the first time in 5, 6, 7 years, where we're seeing a lot of really good stars at a world level competing for Ireland. And if that's not going to excite you, nothing will.
100%. I do wonder, like, as I feel the excitement as well. The country feels the excitement about this. And again, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong here, but again, recalling from that conversation in 2016, I think there was a sense that we don't really know if the IAAF has the handle on a clean sport for this Olympic Games. I think was maybe the gist of your point. And I'm not sure, if I'm analysing my emotion coldly, if a wave of Irish success is just cosmetic, and actually under the bonnet there are still all these questions to be asked that gave you concern in 2016, and maybe if we're coldly analysing it should continue to give us concern about the sport.
No, I think the World Athletics are really doing the best they possibly can to be able to police the sports, but the only problem is there's always going to be dopers out there, there's always going to be chemists and doctors who are ahead of the posse all the time, there's always going to be new substances that will be on trial, and there's going to be always some bogus coaches out there and agents out there who've got access to the latest drug therapy out there that's going to enhance the performers. Athletes will do anything they can do to improve their performance, whether it's 1 or 2%. The slightest little improvement can be the difference between gold, silver, bronze or fourth. No question about that. So there's always going to be ways athletes are going to look for improvement, whether it's the diet, whether it's the medical support, whether it's their rest, the new shoes that's out there.
Yeah.
They're always looking for these, but it's when you cross the line. It's when you cross the line and you start getting involved in doping, then it's not worth it. Because if you do win a medal, whatever colour it might be in Olympic Games, and you know in your heart and soul that you took drugs, I wouldn't want to be carrying that on my shoulders for the rest of my life.
Well, certainly that Finnish athlete is maybe evidence of that, but maybe not all athletes are born again Christians after they've taken drugs.
Yeah.
Eamon, so Goal Mile, full week this week, you're saying, for people to get out and do this. Just a final word, just give that a bit of a plug. It's a phenomenal event to be involved with, and getting out into the cool, crisp air in December. It's a great way to kickstart Christmas.
Absolutely. All we're doing, this is my new theme now, is 1 mile, one mission to help those children who have been devastated, really, really devastated by poverty and crisis around the world, who need our help. So you can do your goal mile at any of the locations around Ireland or around the world. And if you can't even go to a location near you, you can do your own virtual mile. So all you have to do is to log on to goalmile.org to register. And whatever few quid you have, if you like to run, if you like to jog, if you like to go for a walk in the park, well, just think that 1 mile will make a big difference this year by participating in the Golden Mile for these kids.
Absolutely. Eamon Coughlin, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Owen.
Off the Ball Daily.